Good morning.
Good morning.
You guys are kind of tilted over there. Now I'm getting vertigo. What are you doing? Why are you all over there?
It's the energy over there.
The energy. Wow. You get like a stomach.
I've been sweating a lot.
You've been sweating a lot in the kitchen? Is that it? Uh-huh. All right. Well, maybe you should sit right in the middle and give everyone a chance for acceptance. That would be very good. So, good morning, everybody. Nice to see you. It's always amazing when I come out of my little rabbit hutch there. And then everybody's here. My teacher's Dokusan room used to be a chicken coop. We would meet in the chicken coop. And I asked them, has anyone ever hatched in here? Didn't answer. It's a very nice chicken coop. So, as you know, yesterday we were, I began talking about some views of compassion and tying it together with Atisha's mind training slogans, and some commentary by Pema Chodron. It's a kind of nice combination. And we talked about training and the preliminaries. Remembering that life is precious, that life is impermanent, that all things are impermanent, that everything that we do is the cause of some result. To remember these things, not just like hear them today and forget about it, but to remember them every day. And that when we're caught up in our own self-concern, with the kind of comparative and judgmental mind that we most of us tend to carry around about being important or unimportant or good or bad or right or wrong or better or worse or, I don't know, you know, all of that stuff, and that we suffer. And I think those preliminaries alone are a lifetime of practice. But the Buddha Dharma has never stopped with the idea that you should just have one lifetime of practice. And so, we have more teachings. We also discussed yesterday regarding all dharmas as dreams, as a way of reminding us to stay in the present moment, not get caught, not get lost in that. Some of the mind training slogans that I want to discuss with you today are difficult ones. They may even be difficult for you to hear, without using them against yourselves. That's one of the ways you know that there's a reason for the slogan, is that they seem to apply. And remember that the purpose of these mind training slogans is to help us apply them so that our hearts can awaken and the tenderness of our being and of our nature can awaken right in the middle of real life. And so I'm going to ask you to hear them, but not to say, yeah, that's me and that's bad. Just to say, as we used to say in the 60s, I can dig it. Like, you know, you're really acting like a jerk. But yeah, I can dig it. In other words, to just hear it. And try not to use it against yourselves, because the tendency is when we hear something that we don't like about ourselves being reflected back to us, and that's one of the things I'm going to talk about, we use it against ourselves. It doesn't help. It never helps. So the first one, you may have heard this idea of eating the blame and in Buddhism. And the mind training slogan of Atisha was drive all blames into one. Drive all blames into one. And this one is about the fact that there are other people in the world and with whom we have to live and work and share the planet. And because there are other people in the world, it turns out things get messed up. If only we were the only people. Things would go just perfectly. But actually, my oldest friend, Kenny, who I love dearly, we were born one block apart, born 6 days apart in the same neighborhood. And when we traced our background, we found that our families came from 50 miles apart in Eastern Europe. And he and I are oldest friends. And he said it quite succinctly. He said, "Hell is other people." But he's a New Yorker, you can tell, right? Hell is other people. What's hell? Hell is other people. So because there are other people, things tend to get messed up. Because to the other people, we're the other people. You understand? And so it's pretty common when things get messed up to not to want to be known as the one who messed up. And so it's pretty common that we shift the blame like that. I didn't do it, you did it. They did it. It's not my fault. We just shift the blame right away. Have you noticed this? I didn't think it was just the people on my block doing it.
Karen
Pardon?
Karen took the blame, actually, when she came in.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's the one.
Yeah. Yeah. But that was an act of pride. She wanted you to know who made all of you shift over to us. Right? Nothing gets by us. Actually, it was a sweet act of pride. I'm sorry. Couldn't help. I'm living proof. Hell is other people. So, but when we do shift the blame, that's an act of violence. And we should know what we're doing. It is an act of aggression to shift the blame, to say something's wrong in the situation and that person did it. That's a violent act. And the person, as you know, because it's all been done to you, right? You feel violated right away. You feel attacked. It's a very aggressive thing to do. And so the mind training slogan, "Drive all blames into one," says try something different. Try a different approach. And, you know, looking honestly at yourself. And it is in our real best interest to look honestly at ourselves. And rather than seeking a way to blame other people, which just increases the aggression and the violence, you know how quickly that escalates, it also brings despair into our lives. Because as soon as we start to feel that we're in this sort of aggressive and violent situation, we start to lose the taste for the goodness of life. We start to lose how wonderful it feels to be alive. And suddenly we're consumed by the battle. And we lose the preciousness of life. Actually, life doesn't seem so good, does it? It seems like I'm in a fight and I've got to win, and we're all the way back to what I was talking about yesterday. And it happens, it's just as soon as we shift the blame. So we get despairing. But if we try this new thing, driving all blames into one, and I'll talk about that a little more, we just see ourselves trapped by the game where we're trying to get out of responsibility for something. We can actually become tenderhearted and say, "Oh, look, here I am. Here's that person suffering again because they're scared." Only because we're scared. And we can feel tenderness. I mean, if you see someone who's frightened, don't you feel tender? Say, let me see, how can I help them? Because they're so scared. This is an opportunity for us to stop and offer some of that tenderness to ourselves. And it's a wonderful part of the practice. And then that tenderness gets stronger. And instead of shifting the blame to somebody else, we can actually stop and allow a tenderness to come to us. That act of self-compassion that I was talking about yesterday. And we know it's not so easy to do it. We all know it's very hard. Because the impulse to get out from under the gun is really strong. But when we are willing to de-escalate a situation. Simply by not shifting the blame. You notice I haven't said what to do yet. I've just said, don't shift the blame. Just right in that neutral position. Before anybody can figure out what's going on. Just don't do that. That causes a de-escalation, right? Remember, every action causes some, is the cause of some result. That causes the result of the de-escalation of a potentially violent and aggressive situation. And then, we actually look like geniuses. We actually might be someone that other person wants to talk to in a reasonable way. We create a situation where really getting together and figuring out what's going on can happen. So that action, simply not doing, has a huge effect. And it's the effect of peacemaking, believe it or not. We become peacemakers in that moment. And, you know, also the other person may say, oh, gee, they're not so dangerous. And then they will lower their hackles. Because, you know, when something goes wrong, everybody runs for the hills. It's not just one person. Everyone says, oh, I didn't do it. No, I didn't do it either. Nobody did it. Right? So everybody is already in a defensive position. Simply don't shift and things go better. And it's also, you know, we should consider the benefits of not shifting the blame. You know, first of all, we might be wrong. We might be mistaken about how we're perceiving the situation. And if we are mistaken, we should know it. I mean, ask your best self. When you're mistaken about something, don't you want to know it? You do want to know it. I mean, we're not perfect. I mean, or as Suzuki Roshi said, we are perfect, just as we are, and we could use a little improvement. So this is a chance for us to practice the improvement part. Yeah. But we should know when we're making a mistake so that we don't compound the mistake by arguing on behalf of, you know, that mistake. And also, whether we're right or wrong doesn't really matter. The fact of the matter is that when we are caught in a reactive mode, our usual habit of protecting ourselves, we suffer. If we're right, we suffer. If we're wrong, we suffer. And we suffer not because we're either right or wrong, but we suffer because we go to the battlements. We cause the argument. So it's important for us to know what's actually going on, and it's important for us to simply not cause an cause a fight. Because we suffer. And then there's the future effect of causing this fight, of shifting the blame this time. And that is a big one. Every time we do it and succeed, we strengthen our own self-righteousness. Self-righteousness, instead of self-truth, becomes stronger. So then we tend to rely on it more and more and more, and pretty soon we become a self-righteous, not so pleasant person. As our major mode of relating. Like, you know, if you get very good at being self-righteous, can you imagine wanting to call yourself and say you want to go to the movie? No way that you will want anything to do with yourself. Because that's a very unpleasant person to be around. So simply, just simply not shifting the blame, just even holding it in neutral, is something that's really important to do. And we're in a relationship all the time. So I urge you to take that one really to heart. The thing about other people, or one of them, relates to this next one. The next mind training slogan is be grateful to everyone. This is tough. Sounds nice on the surface. But this is really tough because other people are geniuses at mirroring back to ourselves when we're, you know, not quite on top of our game. You see it in their face, you see it in their actions, you hear it in their words, you see it in the way they relate to you. Other people just have an instinct for knowing how to push our buttons and let us see right then and there, or even help us create the situation in which we're just not quite as, you know, good as we would like to be. You know, when we're caught functioning in our habitual patterns, basically. And without other people, however, we might not know that we're not living our deepest aspiration, to live to the best of our ability a wholesome life on behalf of all beings. We might think we're doing a great job if it wasn't for other people mirroring to us. You know, that mirroring is an act of compassion. The person may be doing it just because they can't stand us, but that's not the point. That is an act of compassion. And when other people mirror back to us that we're acting in that way, we can actually be grateful for it. And that is very tough to do. I think about it. How willing are you to have that mirroring in your life so you can just walk around feeling so grateful all the time? And I think you'll find you're not that willing to do it. But Atisha says, be grateful. Be grateful to everyone, no matter what the nature of the situation is. You know, and when we're not so grateful, even though this person is giving us a chance to look at ourselves, honestly and truly. Remember you all said that if you made a mistake, you'd like to know. All of a sudden someone's saying, hey, I think you made a mistake. He's saying, I don't want to know about that. That's what we do. It means becoming so subtly aware, in the moment of our behavior, of our words, of our deeds, of our feelings, that we're able to stop it. And instead of going to the battlements, going to gratitude. And I want to say that it takes courage. Gratitude takes courage in a situation like this. And we don't usually think of it in that way, but it takes true wisdom and compassion when we don't like what we see in the mirror. True wisdom and compassion, and a deep connection to our aspiration to live in the Buddha way, to refrain from blaming the mirror or smashing the mirror. You think about it. Put it in a real situation. If somebody mirrors back to you, let's just call it a less than wholesome behavior, and it will take every bit of you to feel grateful to them. It'll take every bit of you to connect to compassion in the midst of that situation. It'll take every bit of you to act wisely in that situation. It'll take every bit of us, every single bit of us, to remember, I want to live an awakened life. Because that reactive pattern is so ingrained. It just shows up like that. So it takes consciousness. That's what we're talking about. It takes conscious awareness and the ability to remember what our deepest vow is in order to not just do the habitual thing. And in some way, you have to remember that when we do bring that awareness to ourselves, we are, in that moment, compassionately enacting our vow to save all beings, starting with us. That's what it looks like. You know, I don't know if you have some fancy idea of what saving all beings mean, or you may have no idea what it means. You just say it and hope that someday we understand something. But this is a real practical way to do it. And so the practice of gratitude in the midst of a tough situation takes an enormous amount of courage. And it takes a constant practice of it, a desire to remain aware in the middle of the situation. I encourage you to try it. Next time somebody says something to you and you just want to tear their head off, as an instant, stop. And see if there's some gratitude that you can find in the midst of that situation. It will be hard, I promise you. These ingrained habits are deep, really deep. Not just deep personally, species deep. Because remember, the species wants to get rid of anything that threatens its existence. And the ego functions as an ego species. Anything that threatens the existence of the ego or the comfort of the ego, it wants to vanquish. So we're fighting against the way our egos have formed and developed in order to simply feel gratitude. You know, gratitude is called one of the soft sciences. Right, it's accomplished by people who are just so nice, or so wise that we just feel so lucky to be around them. But the fact of the matter is, is that gratitude is available to us. And so to be grateful to everyone we meet is a pretty good teaching. You know, if somebody were to say to you, let's say you met somebody and they said, hey, look, you know, I've got this magic way to reduce your suffering and help you cut through all your delusions so you can be liberated. You'd say, great, lay it on me. Well, guess what? When someone mirrors our behavior to us, that's exactly what they're doing. That's exactly what they're doing. So, a word to the wise, as they say. Once, I think I told you this, but once I asked my teacher in Doksan, isn't Manjusri's sword, you know, he's the bodhisattva of wisdom, and he carries the sword, isn't Manjusri's sword the same as Kanzeon's heart? Kanzeon is the bodhisattva of compassion. So isn't the sword of wisdom the same as the heart of compassion? And he said, yes, that's true. He said, but one edge of Manjusri's sword gives life, and one edge takes it away. And I thought about it, because that was his response, and I thought, okay, what is he telling me about compassion? And I realized that without compassion, you would not know whether to give life or to take it away. That compassion has to be at the heart of wisdom, or wisdom can't be wisdom. Wisdom is foolishness. Without compassion at the heart, without knowing, sometimes you need to bring life to life, and sometimes you need to cut through the delusion, take away the life of the delusion. And in either case, it's compassion. So I want to encourage you to imagine that the person who is mirroring you is worthy of your gratitude. And when you are grateful in that moment, that is an act of compassion for the self. So you're actually giving yourself compassion by doing that and saving all the grief of all the struggles that you create otherwise. The next, does that make some sense to you? It's very tough. We should acknowledge that it's very tough. But these mind training slogans are reminders. Always be grateful to everyone. So next time somebody, you know, is doing something that you just want to tear their head off, you say, oh, you know, Atisha said, always be grateful to everyone. All right, how am I going to do that? That's a good question to ask. That's the right question in that situation, as opposed to, how should I kill him? That's not such a good question. The next one is always maintain a joyful mind. See, I told you these are going to be tough. Always maintain a joyful mind. Wow. Well, I'll give you a little bit of a key about this. When we experience gratitude, think about it. When you experience gratitude, don't you feel joyful? Joy is not separate from gratitude. Joy is a natural experience of feeling grateful. When we feel grateful, often we feel humble in some way. We're just so grateful that we feel our smallness and we feel how fortunate we are. And it's a wonderful way of being humbled in the world. And one of the experiences of being humbled in the world is joy. We think it's the opposite. Like, we think getting will make us joyful, but actually being humbled, and especially through gratitude, is a major way to feel joy in the world, right in the middle of our hard times, right in the middle of a hard life. And in the Buddhist teaching, in Atisha's teaching, one of the reasons to maintain a joyful mind is that you always have your practice to help you. You can be joyful because you have your practice to help you right in the middle of that difficult time. You can say, boy, this is really tough. I am so happy I have my practice. And I have said that many, many, many times. Remember I told you years ago when they told me I had liver cancer? And I just sort of, is that right? I have liver cancer. And then I walked away, and then I was walking down the street, and suddenly I heard it, and I went straight into panic. I just went, boop, panic. And I was just, I was having, hyperventilation. And then that night, I still was hyperventilating. And I thought, I don't want to be doing this, but my body went straight to panic. You know, my body and mind went straight to panic. And all night long, Shirley stayed up with me, and she just kept saying to me, Peter, do your practice. Peter, do your practice. Peter, do your practice.
What do you say?
That's exactly right. And I just kept going back. Follow my breath, 1 second, gone. Follow my breath, 1 second, gone. Follow my breath, 1 second. Oh, my poor son, his father's going to die. Follow my breath, 1 second. Oh, Shirley, you poor thing. You know, on it. Oh, this is going to kill my mother, except she was dead already. But my mind just went completely nuts, you know, because I had been given this, you know, I knew liver cancer. I don't want liver cancer. And I had that practice, and finally, just by doing it again and again and again and again, I was able to finally show up and be present and take in the situation as it was. If I didn't have that practice, I really don't know what I would have done. So I was so grateful and so joyful to have the practice right in the middle of the hell of that moment. So that after they discovered that I didn't have liver cancer, they said, good news. We were wrong, you don't have liver cancer, but it looks like you might have bone cancer. I said, oh, all right, well, let's check that out. Because I had used the practice, I was able to then face the next mistaken diagnosis, these doctors, but I was able to face the next mistaken diagnosis straight on, calmly and clearly, and just take it. So I really think that, you know, we could be grateful to our practice, and we can even, you know, find another way to be grateful. We can thank our problems. Because remember what Pema said? Our problems are the raw material that help us to awaken the genuine heart, right? We can do that. It may sound absurd to you. People might think you're kind of like crazy if you do that. But the fact of the matter is that deep inside of yourself, if you know that what your real job is, what you're really doing, is working to live the Buddha way, is working to live a bodhisattva's life, this stuff is great nourishment. You know, you don't become a compassionate being able to relate to all beings by having no problems. So we can actually change the way we approach our problems by thanking them. The next training slogan is abandon any hope of fruition. I love this one because do you remember what it said on the inscribed over the gates of hell in Dante's Divine Comedy? Abandon hope, all ye who enter here. Right. I thought, oh great, Atisha, he prefigured Dante by 400 years. It's not bad. Yeah, Buddhist guys are pretty good. This is just simply a reminder to stay in the present. So abandon any hope of fruition. You know, we all do. We practice and we want something from it. This means don't practice with a gaining idea, Suzuki Roshi said. Don't practice with a greedy mind. I'm going to practice and I'm going to get that. This is actually antithetical to our practice. In a way forbidden by Dogen's teachings. When Dogen said that you don't practice in order to attain realization, that practice itself is realization. That's the foundation of our practice. You don't practice to become realized because you're already realized. You practice as an expression of your realization. That's Dogen's teaching. That's a revolution in understanding, by the way. Whereas, you know, if you're just if you follow the Santa Claus song, you know, where if you're just good enough, you get to have a lollipop or something. I think I told you that once. That song, that Santa Claus is Coming to Town, that's one of the cruelest songs in the world. I mean, you know, you better not shout, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming. You know, it's like the mafia. Don't make a sound, Don Santa Claus is coming. He's making a list. He's checking it twice. He's going to find out. It's a terrible song. The children all over the Western world are terrified the night before Christmas. I hope I was good enough to get a football. Anyway, this one is very, 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 very important, because this gets right down to the heart of how well we know ourselves. And this one may be, of all of them, this one may be the hardest to accept. I don't know about accept. To hear. Because it can be used against us so easily. We can use it against ourselves so easily. And it's, don't act with a twist. And what Pema said is, this means don't allow our ulterior motives that benefit the ego self to rule what we do. This takes a lot of discernment. Don't allow our ulterior motives that benefit the ego self, as opposed to the big self that we truly are, to rule us. It means don't be sneaky. Don't be tricky. Don't be tricked by the ego that contrives tricky, sneaky things. In other words, become aware of our hidden agendas. Look deeply into our hidden desires, the ones that we can't even bear to admit, and stay aware of them. In spiritual communities, this is very, very tricky stuff, because, as you know, in spiritual communities, the more you do, or the better you look, right? Supposedly, that means realization. You know, when you look at Calvinism, do you know much about Calvinism? You know, the idea of the elect? You know? If you're living well, and you got a Cadillac, and three people taking care of your lawn, it means God loves you. And if you don't, Santa Claus is coming. Right? That's the basis of Calvinism. There is an elect, and you know who they are because they're the rich people in town. They're the people who are doing well. That means God loves them. Yeah.
So where does compassion and generosity fit into that thinking?
I haven't noticed it. I have to say, I mean, it's a critique. It's a broad critique, but I haven't noticed it. Because it's such a strict way of looking at things. It's really, it's pretty punishing, is what I want to say. So that, of course, the poor people, they're poor because God doesn't love them. In other words, they deserve it.
Right, so there would be no room for compassion.
Not really, no. You know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I don't have boots. Well, that's because God doesn't love you. Yeah, Aaron.
Do the elect tithe?
I think there is a tithing. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that's true, as I remember it. So this one, don't act with a twist. Very, very tricky. And it means that we have to look at our real motivations. Look at our real motivations without judgment. Without saying, I did that, and I did it for this good reason, and now I've discovered that actually I was seeking to benefit some part of myself that doesn't feel so good. I'm a phony. I'm a fraud, right? That judgment, right? I'm a phony, I'm a fraud, I'm no good, I shouldn't be relied upon, all that attack that will come in it. That's why this is so dangerous. Because it means looking and discerning at our real motivations, simply to see what they are, so that we can become free from them. Not so that we can use them against ourselves. acting with a twist is something that most people do at one time or another, and it means getting so hip to our games that we are not fooled by our ego self and the contrivance of our egos. You know, it doesn't matter what the motivation is. The motivation may be a secret need to be seen or thought of in a certain way, because we just have never been seen or thought of in a way that feels good to us. And yet we still have that need to be seen or thought of in that certain way. And so the ego needs to be bolstered, and it contrives a way to get it, and it looks good on the outside, but something is not quite right way down deep, and we know it. Somewhere, somehow, in the deep part of our mind, our unconscious, we know it. And so we act in a way that seems wonderful and is doing good and all these great things. And the ego is the thing that's getting stronger. And the self-knowledge is the thing that's not getting stronger. Do you see how it works? You know, and so you can see why I say, don't judge yourself for it, because we're barely conscious of this, the functioning of this contrivance. We're barely conscious of it. And if we are conscious of it, sometimes it's so painful that we shove it back down into the unconscious. In other words, we're suffering. You go around and tell people who are suffering from that kind of, you know, struggle in the deep part of the mind that they're bad for, you know, acting out in that struggle because they haven't completely been liberated from it. That's just cruelty. This is when we need compassion the most. Again, to see ourselves with compassion instead of judgment, to discern what our real motivations are, and to understand what they are with real, real non-judgmental discernment, simply because we need to know. Because if we can become free of the grip of that unconscious appetite or hunger, we can really become free. Because that's where it grabs us. And we see it in behavior all the time. This is, I think of this as giving as taking. A form of giving as a way of taking. I know some people who hug me too long. And I'm just giving you a hug, but I'm starting to feel like I'm going to, like, you know, I'm going to be strangled to death or something like that. They're not in touch with me. They're hugging because they have an idea that a long hug is a good thing, and they want to be a good long hugger. And, you know, they're not realizing that actually I'm, you know, like I'm part of that hug, and I'm not having a good time. Why do they need to hug me for 25 minutes? I mean, you know, just, you know, like, I'm the kind of person who's like, how you doing? Good. You know, just, you know, tip of the hat is enough for me. I mean, 5-minute hug is enough to make me want to run for my life. And I actually feel them taking during the hug. You felt it, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, women have an opportunity to feel this quite often, much more than men do. Have you ever noticed someone who really loves to talk to you about your problems? Why do they need to talk to you about your problems so much and so often and so long? Is it really for you? Haven't they noticed that you're getting more and more depressed? I'm serious about this. They just keep saying, and how are you today? Oh, God, I hear that. I just want to run for my life. I was fine until you asked me. You know? And they just talk on and on and on, because they're the one who's going to understand you, and they're the one who's going to help you, and they're the one you can rely on. It just goes on and on and on. And they lose touch with you, and it's really for them. They're doing it for them. It looks like they're giving. They're really taking.
But that's a perfect opportunity to practice gratitude.
That is a perfect opportunity. Yeah, say more.
Well,
I mean, if you can.
Yeah, I don't know. Sticking with the hugging thing, and if you hug back, maybe you can put them at ease. You know, there's something behind the hug.
Mm-hmm. There's something behind the hug, and it's, you know, this is where the mirroring part comes in too, because you can actually mirror if they're able to see what's in the mirror without feeling rejected, you know. You can mirror back through your hug, that's true. But still, when we're the one doing it, we need to know we're doing it. And that's what don't act with a twist means. It really means check what you're doing. You know, when I say, have you ever noticed people who do this? Of course, I'm talking about when we do it. And it's very important that we do it. It means getting really aware of our ulterior motives. And I want to say that that we have our ways that are called coping strategies in the world. For example, when I was younger, say young man, maybe 20, 21 years old, something like that, honestly and truly, I could keep an entire dinner party laughing all night. I was very funny. I was very, very funny. And everybody thought I was just so funny. But I was not funny because I was funny. I was funny because I was terrified. I was so shy and so anxious as a boy that I learned that I could relieve my anxiety and control an entire situation by making sure everybody laughed. So I would go on for hours sometimes. I mean, it's just amazing. And it took me growing up a little bit and through my practice and maturing a little bit to realize, you know what? I'm uncomfortable. I don't feel good. Like, I would go home, everybody would be laughing and having a great time. I'd go home and feel terrible. And I had to look and say, why do you feel so bad? Everyone was laughing. And the answer was, I feel so bad because everyone was laughing. I was actually scared the whole night. I was so shy and so anxious that I became personally, socially sort of, you know, adept at this, you know, like a trick, basically. And I can't tell you the relief it was to drop that behavior. I can't tell you how wonderful it was to say, you don't have to do that. You're just scared. You're just shy, so you can't shut up. You know, coping strategy. And that was the beginning of seeing deeply into what was at the root of my own shyness and my own anxiety and, you know, all of that. It was the pathway. So again, it was seeing and being willing to admit it was an act of compassion for the self that ended up, you know, frankly, benefiting a lot of other people because they didn't have to listen to me talk all night. Actually have a reasonable conversation that I wasn't controlling. Think about ways in which you may do this. Ways in which you may act with a twist. Ways in which you make yourself the go-to person in some way that may not have as its root the motivation that you think it has or that you hope people will think it has. And here's what's tricky about that, and this is very important. A lot of good has been done in the world by ulterior motives. A lot of good has been, a lot of people have benefited by people who have ulterior motives and who act on those ulterior motives unconsciously. They don't even know they have ulterior motives. A lot of good has come from it. But fortunately, we have a practice that is about waking up. So whether good has come from it or not is not really the point. The point is, do we know ourselves? Have we clarified our minds? Have we clarified our hearts in a way so that the unbounded compassion, without any or as little as possible being consumed and eaten by the ego itself, can flow forth into the world? It's a noble goal, you know. The Bodhisattva path, as far as I understand it, is the natural path of human beings. And so if we're really devoted to helping all beings and to helping life in every form, to being of use to life in every way, you know, we can take a couple of knocks in the form of self-knowledge. We can take a couple of hits in the head and say, yeah, you know what? Yeah, I know, I look that way, but actually I need to know this about myself. So it doesn't get in the way, maybe the next time. And thank you so much for helping me see it, either the other person or your own honesty, your own willingness to do it on behalf of all beings. I think it's crucial that we are willing to look at ourselves in this non-judgmental way, that we're willing to admit, yes, that's with a twist. Let's see if I can untwist that a little bit and still provide, you know, some help and some benefit. Because then it's a little more clear, a little more free. The hug is the right hug instead of the hug that takes. To use the, you know, hug as an example. I think that if we do that, we release a kind of love in our heart that's been bound up by the ego serving. You know, ego serving keeps love from flowing. Because the ego is this tiny little thing that's so all-consuming, as you know. The last one, because we're almost at the end, is all activities should be done with one intention. All activities should be done with one intention. And this is what I'm talking about, and have been talking about. Our one intention is our bodhisattva vow, to help and to save and to liberate all beings. That's our one intention. And when we remember that we want to increase the intimacy, we want to increase the connection, we want to increase the ability that we're able to, our ability to help all beings, that vow comes from our deepest nature. That comes from our true selves. That's our true self speaking. And when we act with that as our intention, we will be able to withstand the self-knowledge that I've been talking about, and that these mind slogans help us to remember. We can ask ourselves, are my words and deeds in line with this vow, with this one intention? Are they in line with it? If they are, great. If they're not, we have ways of gratefully and compassionately working with ourselves. These are practical slogans. If someone else helps us to see it, thank you very much. If we have the courage to see it ourselves, thank you very much. If we can practice this on a regular basis, and there's nothing but opportunities to practice it, as you know, in our daily lives. You know, we're practicing, working with being bound up by our habitual ego-serving patterns. That's all we're doing. That's all we're doing. It's not about good and evil or all this crazy stuff. Simply working with our habitual ego patterns, we can, in fact, on behalf of all beings, attain a kind of liberation. When you hear all of these and you think about what our practice of Zazen is, this simple practice, every single one of the things I've talked about occurs on that pillow. There isn't anything that does not occur right on that pillow if we allow it to. Every time all those different mind states that I've talked about, those habitual patterns come up in fantasy or, you know, whatever form of craziness you're driving yourself crazy with at, you know, during any Zazen period, approaching it with a compassionate, non-judgmental, willing to see, discerning mind, and letting it go strengthens your ability to do that as you encounter it in the world of other people. And it's a great and compassionate act, first on behalf of the self, largely, or in a larger way, on behalf of all beings. And so Pema says, finally, we should train in the three difficulties. The first difficulty, or the three difficult practices: one, recognize your neurosis as your neurosis. In other words, recognize, yeah, that's what I do. Mm-hmm. I do that. Then, don't do it. Do something different to interrupt this neurosis. And the different thing you do is remember the mind slogan. So recognize it. Oh yeah, here it is. I'm doing that again. Wait, drive all blames into one. I have a good idea. Be grateful to everyone. That's what the slogans are used for. And three is to make this practice your way of life. That's pretty nice, don't you think? And I told you, Zen is a very practical, mystical practice. Very practical. I think these mind training slogans are really wonderful. A way to help us be the people that we are. So that our true nature can benefit life itself. We have a minute or two or something like that. Anybody have anything they'd like to say? Yeah, Judith.
I really appreciated you, your caution about some of this as you've gotten into it. And I just wanted to say a couple of things about that, because I think one of the things that has caught me unawares was, I think I went into this notion as I deepened the practice and began to look more deeply at myself. It would be a lightening and, you know, letting go. But there certainly has been at least some place in that process, and it's of depression when you start to see, or when I start to see, all of the ways that I'm not the nice person I thought I was, and I'm not the kind person. I see my twists. Mm-hmm. And I find it really hard sometimes not to get lost in that place of being overwhelmed by all of the tumbling down, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that helped me, I'm in the midst of this recently, I was reading something with The Everyday Zen of Choko Beck.
Mm-hmm. Choko Beck. Choko. Mm-hmm.
And she talked about running into this in students regularly, where it's kind of a Pandora's box notion, right? Mm-hmm. Because everything you said, you know, will ultimately take you to this place. And I guess what I'm wanting to add, or have you say something else about, is in the midst of all that, I've found that there has to be some, whether it's, like you say, the devotion to the vow, the depth of faith or trust in the practice, that can really get tested because of just the
tested
the
and
real muckiness and of this. This is really mucky stuff.
Yeah, tested and strengthened. I mean, let's. Can we talk about you for a second?
Okay. Our mirror.
But I don't mean in a, you know, detailed way. But let's say that somebody came to you and said, you know, I'm feeling, you know, that I mean, I want to be this kind of person, and I'm not that. I don't seem to be able to be that person consistently or all the time, and I'm just so depressed, and I just don't know what to do. What would your instinct be?
Well, of course you can't be anything all the time.
Yeah, right.
Nothing. Everything's impermanent.
But what would your instinct to be to do in relationship to that person?
To comfort.
Yeah, absolutely. You would embrace them.
Yes.
You would say, "Oh, come over here." You
not know, too long.
Come over here. Not too long. But you would take them in, wouldn't you? You would take them in. You wouldn't push them away. You would take them in. You would allow the loving heart to open and say, this poor suffering being, all this person wants to do is be able to, you know, be their best, truest self, and look how they're suffering. Come here, darling, let me help you. And you would seek to help. And that remembering, right, remembering some of these mind training slogans, or remembering to act with the one intention, means that you immediately would bring compassion to that person, right? So when it happens in the self, right, within the ego struggle, the first response, instead of the habitual neurosis of, yeah, you're bad, and you know, you're not what you said you are, and you're, you know, is, let me see how I can help you, the first response. It's the change from the old to the new, mm-hmm. from the habit of blaming ourselves for, you know, being human, basically, to, let's see how I can help you. Oh yeah, let's see, what are my tools? Oh, compassion. Oh, there's one. Non-judgment. Oh, there's one. Feeling gratitude. There's one. Always maintaining a joyful mind. Oh, there's one. And suddenly you have some tools to approach the self. But it's a practice and we must do it. It's not enough to say these words. We must apply it. These are meant to be applied. And so when the muckiness comes up and it's murky, it is. And that's why I warned you. I said, this is stuff that you may not want to hear. But when you remember that your vow is to clarify the heart and mind as an act of compassion to all of life, including you, not excluding you, you hang on to that vow. And that will help you not do the habitual thing. It just turns it right over. And that's where what you're calling faith or trust or something gets tested. It does get tested, indeed. But the test is what makes it strong. And so by doing it over and over and over again, it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. Kaz Ta-Nehisi, you know, who's a friend of ours, Sangha, you know, old close friend of mine, said to me once, if our children have no problems, we should give them some. Yeah, why is that? It's the same thing. These are the problems, the difficulties that come to us. Yes, we can be grateful for them too. And turn it over. And that's why having the practice and having these slogans as reminders are wonderful ways of doing that.
One kind of follow-up from what you just said. So in the midst of the muckiness, mm-hmm. which when what you may be feeling, or certainly what I can get in touch instantly with feeling, is real deep disdain or maybe it's hatred. Mm-hmm. And so to switch to a feeling as dramatically different mm-hmm. as compassion, I can maybe intellectually or say to myself, mm-hmm. but to then feel those things, it's
feeling is overrated. Remember what I said? Compassion is not necessarily a feeling. It's a disposition of heart and mind. It's an approach to life. It's an intention to act in a certain way that will bring the wholeness out. You may not feel it. You may feel terrible. But when you go to the compassion doctor, you have all these ways to approach that one who feels terrible. You don't have to feel compassion to act in a compassionate way. Mm-hmm. Compassion is way, way, way bigger and deeper than an emotion. When you are acting in a compassionate way, sometimes the feeling of compassion comes, but not always. Mm-hmm. We should not define compassion by the feeling that we associate with the word compassion. Compassion is way bigger than that. And those are, you say in an intellectual way, as if that's not okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right? Uh-uh. Sorry.
Yeah.
I say vow. Vow. Okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm having these things and I'm having all this stuff that's going on in my mind. All I have to do is get to the vow. I vow to live as a bodhisattva's life. I vow to save all beings. And right now, I'm the one who's drowning. Okay. Compassion. I have to go right to that. And the first thing I do is I remove judgment. The very first thing that goes, judgment. I am not going to judge myself for suffering. I just am not going to, because that's part of my vow. Any more than I would judge you if you came to me suffering and I say, oh, she's suffering, she's no good. No, I would not do that, right? And I will not do it to myself either. And it comes from the practice of letting go, which we practice in Zazen, that we're able to do this and function this way in the world. Don't confuse compassion with some kind of sweet feeling. Sometimes it is tough. Remember, one edge of the sword gives life, one edge takes it away.
Yeah.
You're dealing with a sharp sword.
That was very important, actually, because you helped me pull up something that I have seen several times of saying to myself, if I don't feel it, it's not real.
Yeah.
And I do think we can go to those places. And I've caught myself before, mm-hmm. but you know, you just caught me again. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I mean, had the jails are filled with guys who killed her because they loved her. I mean, what are we talking about? Yeah. You know, feeling has been made king.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Sorry, I have the feeling that that may not be the case. Mm-hmm. I have the feeling that something else is going on here,
yeah.
and that we can actually move to that bigger self, that greater understanding, that greater capacity we have to stay in the real world. Mm-hmm. This is real world stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why I decided to teach it at the Sashin, because we need some real tools, and we get lost. We really get lost. And this practice of ours actually is made for the nitty-gritty stuff. It's tough medicine. Zazen is tough medicine. Bodhisattva vow is tough medicine. This is not for, you know, wimps or something. Yeah. Okay, one more. Yeah.
I just want to come back to something that we said, I think, in a previous session, that compassion is also spaciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you're meeting a friend who says, oh God, I feel just full of shit, I'm just a horrible person, you don't go, well, just get better, okay? just quit judging yourself. You actually spend time with them. So what I've discovered is that when I'm beating up myself, it's no good saying to myself, look, just be compassionate and stop thinking that way and get on with it, you know? If I don't take time, it may not even necessarily be time like minutes, but there is, I think we may discover through our practice an experience of spaciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And in that spaciousness, compassion arises. And if for me, it's like I may have to just sit down on the edge of my bed or the edge of my seat or go up to my cushion and just take 2 minutes, 1 minute, to just go, okay, I'm hating myself right now. And then just do some breathing and allow myself to enter into the spaciousness of my practice, and then I can soften. And then if I need a feeling, fine. If I need an attitude, you know, whatever will come. But I think that's where it starts, is in that taking the time like we would with a friend.
Mm. You know, the spaciousness you're talking about is available just in one breath.
Yeah. But sometimes with our practice, it takes longer than that to.
No, for sure. But you know, it's right here.
Yeah.
You know, it's right here. You just take that breath, and you know, one of the attributes of samadhi is a great spaciousness, and we're able to, you know, through our practice, we're able to enter that realm of self called samadhi, of big self, and within that spaciousness, you know, there's room. Lots of room. I know that a very wise woman said to me once, do you know why everything is here? And she went like this, you know, sweep of landscape, you know, every blade of grass, every tree. Why is everything here? Because there's room for it. Because there's room for it. Good point. There's room for it. Mm-hmm. So there's room for our suffering, and there's room for liberation from it. So there's also room for honoring the Tenzo's need for us to go forward. So thank you very much.